I invite you to take your Bibles and open with me in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 4. I remember when I hadn't been a Christian very long at all, that there was a lady at a church up in Madisonville, and she made the comment, and like I say, I was a fairly young Christian, but she made the comment, she goes, "I don't know why Ecclesiastes is even in the Bible. It's the most depressing book that I have ever read." And she goes, "I'm just not sure that it ought to be in Scripture at all." And I thought, gosh, you know, she was a senior lady. She'd been teaching Sunday school for years. And I'd wondered how many people had she so disparaged on the book of Ecclesiastes just in her comments. And if she felt that way in her mind and in her heart, how in the world could you teach it, you know, very well and honestly? And the fact is it's not depressing. It's not depressing at all. It's one of the most honest books that there is, because it tells us how life really is, what we can waste our time on, things that are ineffective. You know, we need to know that. And so oftentimes we're living in some place in our mind. We think, I've got to leave some legacy. There's got to be something that marks and says, I was here. Whether it's a statue or whether it's a monument or whether it's a building that's named after us, whether it's some kind of a grant, you know, some kind of a scholarship, something that says, I was here. And somewhere around 50 years old, there's something that happens to some men, and they call it what? I'm not sure why they call it that at 50, because they call it midlife crisis. But how many men do you know that live to be 100? It's very few, is it? So if you figure that the average guy lives to be, let's just round it off and say 80, midlife then would be when? 40, not at 50. And once you hit 60, you know, I'm not trying to be depressing here, but once you hit 60, the slope is pretty steep. It's going real quick. You know, the speed, and some of you are getting concerned because you're in the 70s and 80s. I'm just telling you, that's just how it is. They opened a new thing they've got there in Madisonville that opened up this weekend where you can go parachute. And jumping out of the airplane, if you've never parachuted, parachuting is fun. In fact, it's quite exhilarating. It's going to cause you to have all kinds of emotions that you didn't even know existed. And parachuting is quite safe. The most dangerous part of parachuting is what? The landing. The landing can be very abrupt. And depending on how you hit, as to how abrupt it's going to be and what the consequences are going to be. And so, you know, to watch these people doing the tandem and coming down, when I did it in the 70s, one tandem. You went to an Air Force base, they taught you for about 2 hours on how to jump, how to pull the cord, and how to roll when you landed. And then they took you up, and you were on your own. And if you missed the little thing, you're on your own. There was no one there riding with you to pull it for you. So you just jumped and you fell. And again, the landing is the hardest part, isn't it? So if we know there's going to be a landing, how are we going to land? If we know that at some point or another that things start winding down, and then we look back to evaluate and say, was my life worth it? What I did, was it of value? Was it a benefit? Is there someone going to say, I am glad that he or she was in my life, they were important to me, they made a difference in me, and I'm not the same person I could have been if it had not been for them. And there are people like that that I've had a chance to meet over my years in ministry and life. And then there's some, gosh, I remember one daughter, she just said, now, when you get ready to do Dad's funeral, I want you to be honest. I don't want you up there lying about him. He was a stinker, and I want you to, you know, he was a stinker in life, and there's no reason to try to clean him up now that he's gone. But close your mouth. You probably already know who it is, but I won't tell you. You'll just have to go on guessing. But how many stinkers do we know in life? Is there more than one? And the reality is there is, isn't there? There's a lot of stinkers out there. So how are we going to live? So looking at chapter 4, beginning in verse 4, we're going to read down, and again, the way that he puts it together, he puts it together in groupings. So we're going to look down through verse 16. But overall, there ought to be joy and contentment and companionship. You know, Paul said that we ought to be content in all states. not meaning Texas, Louisiana, but in all conditions in life, that we ought to be content. We ought to learn contentment, whether it's with much or whether it's with little. And so there ought to be joy and contentment and in companionship. So I saw all the toils and all the successful activity with which a man out of his envy for his neighbor does. And this is vanity and chasing after the wind. The fool, he folds his hands, and he devours his own flesh. Better is one hand full with quietness than both hands full with toil and chasing after the wind. And I turned again, and I saw vanity under the sun. And there is one without a second, and neither a son nor a friend, a brother, to him. There is no end to all of his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches. But to whom shall I, in my toiling and in depriving my soul of its pleasure, to whom shall I leave it? And this is vanity. It is an evil task. Better are two than one. For to them their wages are better for their toil. And if one falls down, his companion can raise him up. But woe to him who is by himself when he falls, and there is not a second there to lift him up. And also they lie down, the two of them, and they are able to stay warm. But the one, there is no warmth to him. And if the one is overpowered, the two are able to stand up against it. Now a string which has been woven together into three cords, it is not quickly broken. And better is the child who is born poor but wise than a king who is old and foolish. He has not know how to receive admonishment any longer. For in the house of chains a king has come forward, and in his kingdom he has borne a child into poverty. And I saw all who live and who are walking under the sun. And there is a second child, one that comes afterward, who rises up after him. And his end is to all the people, and to all it is as it was before them. And also after them there is no one who rejoices in him. And also this is vanity and chasing after the wind. He gives us three different scenarios, three different categories. As he's looking in, it begins and gives us the clue by saying, and I saw, and I saw. So in verse 4, he tells us that he saw, and he says in verse 7, and again I saw, and then again down in verse 15 where he says, and I saw. So he divides it up by that indicator and by that sign. And he talks about that there is that envy or covetousness. How much is done out of envy or covetousness? I remember it was a joke, but that was told by Paul Harvey. But he tells about a man who was building a fence in his backyard. And he dug the post holes, and he put the post in the ground. And his neighbor looked at his fence and thought, gosh, that is going to be such a fine fence. And they're getting ready to go to the lumber yard to get the stringers and get all the pickets. And so the neighbor came over because he was looking at what a nice fence his friend was going to have, his neighbor was going to have. And he goes, would you mind if I borrow your post hole diggers? And the man says, I can't loan them to you right now. We're going to the lumber yard. So he and his son, they get in the truck, and they are driving off to the lumber yard. And the little boy looks at his dad. He goes, Dad, what is it with us going to the lumber yard that you couldn't loan him the post hole diggers? He said, son, when you're making excuses, one excuse is as good as another. And that's a fact of it. Why was the one man wanting to build a fence? Because his neighbor did. How many times have we looked at someone and they're doing some kind of landscaping or something to their house, and we see them out there doing it, and gosh, it looks so nice, and we look at our house, and next thing you know, we're out there and we're digging up the flower bed, and we're going to the, you know, going to the wherever it is, we buy our plants and we get our mulch, and we're out there mulching it away. You know, one neighbor mows his grass, and the other neighbor mowed it 4 days ago, but he looks and his grass had grown up a little bit, and now his neighbor's yard looks so nice. So what's he do? He gets out there and he's mowing. Then the next neighbor looks and he goes, you know, where's the end to it? Where does it ever stop? You know, one lady goes to the mall, and she comes back and she's got a nice purse, and she's already got 37 of them. But she got her a new purse, and, you know, and she looked, and because she got her purse, she had to get shoes to go. I mean, obviously, you got to have shoes if you got a purse, right? And, but I don't have an outfit that goes with my shoes, so now I got to get an outfit to go with my shoes and my purse. And so you go get all of those things, and you come, and your friend sees it and going, gosh, I need a new purse. And I need new. Now, how often do we do things out of that covetousness? We look at our neighbor and we think, gosh, I need that too. No, some things are beneficial. Gosh, the neighborhood looks so much nicer when all the neighbors are competing to keep their yards nice and the property value goes up. There is a benefit to it, but where's an end to it? Where does it ever stop? And that's what he's telling us in verse 4. He says, because there is toil, there's labor, and there's activity that's successful. You actually accomplish something, but it's all done out of envy for the neighbor. It's not done out of one's own self-worth or one's own self-motivation, but looking at envy, that person's got it, and so therefore I need it. I want it. Pride has two daughters, Proverbs tells us. And the two daughters are, I want, I want. Or it can be translated, it's not enough, never enough. And pride has that. And so when we look and we are not satisfied with what we have, when we're always wanting something more, then at that point, Solomon just says, this activity, it is vanity, it is empty. And again, when we look at it, we use words in Christendom, in English, that are not English words. For example, baptize or baptism is not an English word, is it? It's a transliteration of Greek. And so instead of translating it to immerse, well, the Methodists and the Presbyterians didn't like that translation, because if they're not immersing, they're sprinkling, then we don't like that translation. Therefore, we don't want it translated. We just want to leave it untranslated. We can tell them what it matters or it means, whatever we want it to mean. But the root means to be identified with, an identification. The ships at the bottom of Pearl Harbor will never be identified anyplace else than Pearl Harbor, will they? Because that's where they are. They were baptized there. Or the shirt that gets, the white shirt that got grape juice spilled on it, will never be a white shirt entirely ever again, will it? It's always going to have what on it? A red stain. Now, I don't see red. It's going to be gray to me, but it's still going to be a stain. You won't get it off. It got baptized. It's now identified with the grape juice or wine or whatever it is you spilled on it. It's going to have it there, isn't it? Because it's been identified. It's gone into the fabric. It is what it is. And so it is when we look at vanity, the word vanity is vapor. It's empty. It's like fog. When you chase after it, what have you got? I got me a jar of fog today. All right? What have you got when you've got a jar of fog? You know, you go out in the thickness, it may be foggy tomorrow with the changing of the weather, but you go out there and take a jar, like kids used to get the fireflies, and you go out there and go, put a lid on it. And are you going to have fog in the afternoon in your little jar? No, you know, because the temperature and the humidity, everything's going to change and it's going to dissipate, and you're not going to have, it's going to be gone. And that's exactly what you have, isn't it? Nothing. When you get... And that's what he's saying. It's vanity. It's empty. There's nothing there. And you can chase after the wind, but can you catch it? Can you grab a hold of it? And now I've got it. You know, you can catch a tiger by the tail, maybe. I'm not sure it works that way. I would think if you chase a tiger, he's probably going to chase you back. But if you've got it, what do you have? Well, that you have danger. But you're never going to catch the wind. You can't. And then when he tells us of the fool, the fool doesn't do anything. The fool, it's the other side of it. If one does all of his activity entirely out of jealousy or envy or covetousness for his neighbor, the other guy doesn't do anything. It's the sluggard. And so here he is, the fool. He just sits back and folds his hands. He doesn't do anything. So all he does is devour. In fact, the picture is he devours his own flesh. It's like he's eating his own arm. So the fool, the sluggard, what's he do? A little sleep, a little folding of his hands to rest, and his poverty comes upon him like a thief, is what the proverb says, isn't it? A little sleep, a little, I'll wait till later. It's going to rain. I think I'll stay in. It's too hot. I won't plow today. I need to paint my house, but gosh, you know, there's so many other things to do. I think I'll take a nap. He never gets around to it, does he? Mike gave me a round to it just so I'd have one. So I didn't ever have to worry about getting around to it because I had one. It was a round thing that said to it on it. And it was, so therefore it was what? A round to it. So I never had to worry about getting around to it because I already had one. And then I gave it away because someone told me in the office, they said, you know, I just can't ever get around to it. And I reached up off the shelf and I handed it to him. I said, now there's no excuses, is there? Because now you've got around to it. And so you need to get it done. And that's what we find. Here he is. He just, you know, sits back and he doesn't do anything. I'll get to it tomorrow. I'll get to it, you know. And if I sleep long enough, gosh, it'll just go away. And I won't have to deal with it at all. It just passed by me and then it's all gone. And he says, it's like eating your own flesh. You're devouring yourself. So on the one hand, the person that does everything out of envy is no good. And it's worthless. It's empty. And on the other hand, it's no good to sit and do nothing. And just think, gosh, by doing nothing, I won't have to worry about anything. Better is one hand that's full if you have quietness, you have peace, you can settle down, than having both hands full and having to toil constantly, that you never get a rest. I've got both hands full, but I can't ever sit down to rest with what I've got. It's the guy that decides that, you know, I need a lake house, and I need a beach house, and I need a boat. And if I'm going to get a boat, I got to have one for salt water, and I got to have one for the lake. So now I'm invested, and I've got both hands full, and I got my boat down here at the beach house, and I got a boat up here at the lake, and I've got my house, and I got to mow the grass here, and I got to go down there this weekend. I got to mow the grass there. I got to get back up to the lake sometime. I got to mow the grass there, and gosh, I got some plumbing problems down at the beach. I got to go down there, and never get, you know. I think Ricky Skaggs got a song about that. His big boat's in the driveway, and my little boat's in the lake. And, you know, we got both hands full, and we're constantly toiling, and we never get to enjoy the very thing we have because we're just keep striving to have more and more. And wouldn't it be better to have less and be able to enjoy what you have than to have more and never have time to rest? It just seems to me that you can have too much, can't you? That you're always having, and then, gosh, if you've got too much at the lake, you're going to have to get a security system. Because what if somebody comes and breaks in and steals it? And then we got to deal with insurance down at the beach because we got to have storm insurance, you know, or windstorm. And we probably need flood because if there's a storm comes in, and so I've got to deal with that. And when do you ever get to sit back and enjoy the very things that you've worked and labored for? You don't, do you? So which is better? And so he tells us that all of this, of having to have more and more and more, that all it is chasing after the wind. If envy is chasing after the wind and having more is chasing after the wind, and gosh, doing nothing isn't chasing anything. So we find the two extremes, the workaholic and the fellow who is just completely, utterly lazy. And neither one of them is beneficial. And so there ought to be a contentment in the things that we have with the labor that God's given to us, that we do need to work. We need to work for what we have. And we need to be satisfied with what we do acquire with what we have. The second, he said, I had to stop and do this again. So I returned and I looked again and I saw the vanity that was under the sun. So he looks at a man. And the man's so busy, he never acquires a family. He never settles down to get married. You know, my first house that I built was in Indiana. And the builder, he came by one day and we were working and trying to finish things up, and he asked us to stop and take a break. And the boss I was working for said, well, these guys got to finish up, and we don't have time for a break. He goes, no, I'm paying you. You know, sit down and take a break. And so we sat in the garage, and he had the plywood already there for the trim. And he sat down, and most of us were young men except the boss that we were working for. And he says, guys, you need to get married when you're young. You need to have your kids when you're young. He said, my wife and I, he said, now, I guess he was in his 60s then. He said, my wife and I, we have waited and waited. We kept thinking to ourselves, you know, we'll wait until we got a house, and we'll wait till we've got so much in the bank, and we'll wait. And he said, we've been waiting all these years, and now my wife is had a stroke or something and wasn't doing well. And he goes, and here, now we've worked all of our years to have all this stuff, and we don't have any kids. And because we don't have any kids, we don't have any what? Grandkids. And he said, we've been pursuing, you know, we kept putting it off. He said, don't put it off. You know, you need to think about getting married young and learning together young and growing up with your kids, you know, while you can enjoy them. Because if you wait till you get as old as us, you're never gonna have them. And he said, there's just a whole lot more to life than just working. And, you know, I guess I was 18 years old, and I thought, this guy's just reminiscing. You know, and I listened to a lot of people reminiscing. I was thinking, this guy's just reminiscing. But more and more I thought about it, I thought, you know, he's pretty smart. He's pretty smart. And I kept thinking, gosh, I'm 22 years old. I've waited way too long. You know, gosh, I'm getting married at 22. I should have done this a long time ago, or 23. I should have gotten married at 18 instead of at 22 or 23. Don't wait. You know, you think, well, gosh, I'm not going to have anything. Well, what exactly is it that you want? What do you want out of life? More stuff? Or time to go out and enjoy life and enjoy your family and enjoy your kids? You know, I've got a cousin that got married at 14. She was in high school. She was a sophomore in high school. She got married at 14. I can see y'all. Your mouth is just dropping. She's from Arkansas. You got to give her a break. No, but she got married at 14. And her husband, he was an only child, and his dad owned a lumber yard, and his grandpa owned another lumber yard, and he was the only kid. And so they both got married. They didn't want to date anyone else. They loved each other, and they got married, and they waited till after they got out of college before they had any kids. And gosh, they did quite well. And so now she's got children, she's got grandchildren, and I think one granddaughter's expecting, so she's going to have great-grandkids, and she's 2 years younger than me. You know, they didn't wait. Now, I realize that today ladies are waiting till they're 28 and 30 and 33 to have kids. But why wait? Because he said, there is a man, there's one, but he doesn't have another. There's no partner. There's no one else. There's no one else to partner with him in life. He's living life by himself. So there's one, but there's not two. Nor is there a son or a brother. He's by himself. So here's a man that lives all by himself, all through life. And he said there's no end to all of his toil. He works and he works and he works. And he says, but his eyes are never satisfied with these riches. I knew this man. His name was Mel Kitterman. He had a machine shop in Noblesville, and he had a machine shop in Prescott, Arkansas. He did all of the lathe work and all the machine work for Firestone at their plant in Noblesville and their plant down in Prescott, Arkansas. He had two airplanes. He had a Beechcraft twin engine that had the split tail going down there. Gosh, it was nice. It was really nice. Real nice airplane. Plus, he also had a Piper Cub. And so he had two airplanes. And he had a really nice Lincoln Continental car that he drove to work. And then he had a Cadillac. And had a real nice house up on the lake. And every weekend he was calling my uncle going, what are you doing this weekend? And John goes, well, Bill and I, we're going to do this or that. Why don't you all come with me? Why don't you come out to eat with me? I'll buy your supper. Why don't you come with me? Let's take a fly. Let's go fly someplace. We'll go out. We'll take off this weekend and go fly someplace. Let's go do something. He's by himself. Did all of his labor, everything by himself, and no one to leave it to, no one to raise and train up behind him. You know, gosh, how many kids have learned from their parents, from their grandparents? How many girls have learned to sew and cook from their grandma or from their mother? How many young men have learned to work on the lawnmower or fix a bicycle when they were kids? You know, how to put the chain back on or how to get the handlebars straightened when the handlebars are sideways or crooked, or how to take the tire off when the rim gets bent and to try to straighten it out or put a new tube in the tire. How many kids lack those things because they didn't have someone there to train them? There's a man that was by himself. There wasn't another. There was no companion, there was no son, there was no brother, and there was no end to all of his toil, and his eyes were never satisfied with his riches. But I toil, he says, but to whom? For what? Who am I doing this for? I've deprived my soul of its pleasure. And for why? What have I got to show for it? So we acquire, and if there's no family, if there's no one that we, a wife, a spouse, children, grandchildren, if there's no one that we're close to, then why bother? What exactly? Because you're never satisfied. There's never enough. It's always more and more. And he says, this occupation and this task, I see it to be evil. I see it that it's a vanity and it's an evil occupation. That's a horrible thing to do. It's almost tormenting. that we have lived life and we don't know what we're going to do with it. How many wanted to be kin to Howard Hughes? How many people started showing up out of the woodwork when he died? You know, I'm a distant cousin. You know, he was the third cousin of my Aunt Martha. You know, someplace down there, I've got to be kinfolk. Why? Because he had all that stuff, but who was he leaving it to? Who was there? So he strived and strived, and he accomplished much in his life, didn't he? But what did he ever enjoy? They said he was insane when he died, wasn't he? With all the stuff he had, that he was totally insane. The bizarre things that he was doing at the end of his life. So what exactly do you have out of it? So he comes and he turns and he gives us a proverb. Two is better than one. That's a short proverb, but it's a good one to remember. Two is better than one. Why? He gives us a list. He gives us four reasons why two are better than one. First of all, that to the two of them, they can earn a better wage in their work and in their labor. I worked for years by myself in construction. And the reason for that's because it was hard to find someone that wasn't either a pothead or a drunk in construction. It just is. It's hard to find people that are sane and morally pure and clean to go into that industry. But I remember when I moved to Houston that there were two of us that came down from Indiana. And we could take an apartment complex, two-story apartment complex over on the west side of Houston, off of Bingle. We would take, and we'd take one day, and we'd get one of those front-end loaders and put all the material we needed, because we did all the overhang, everything that was up off the ground, all the overhang, we trimmed it out, and we put the windows in, all of that, and we did all of the all the little patio things that were in between, trimmed all that out. And so it was 2,000 linear feet of soffit, fascia board and all the under. So we loaded up on one day, and we cut it because all the overhang was exactly the same, and we put a 45 degree on all of the 1x6 and stuff that was going for fascia boards. And then I had scaffolding, and we could scaffold down with my scaffolding ladders. We could scaffold one side and down another. And in 4 days, that's one day to load it all up there and cut it, and 3 days to go and go all the way around the building, we were knocking them out faster than they could frame them, both of us. And we were clearing, after all of our expenses, $2,000 a piece a week. Is that good money? Even today, is that good money? And then we'd get so far ahead that the bricklayers, they were having trouble because they didn't know how to set those big metal vents up in the gable on the ends. So they came to us and they said, would you guys do that? I said, sure. How much is it? Well, how much will you do it for? $250 a vent. Sure. So we go down the hardware store and we get a little pulley and we get some rope, some nylon rope, and we get a hook. And we go in there and we screw on some blocks onto the vent. And in about 15 minutes, he'd tie it to the back of his pickup truck. I get on the ladder with my pulley, and I'd run the pulley through the gable and go down to the gable vent. And the thing's about 30, 40 feet across the bottom. And I just walk with it underneath the ladder. We take it up there, screw it in place. 15 minutes, we're done. And the guy goes, I'm paying you too much. I said, but that's what we agreed to, because he had to have it for the brick to go up. And so we were knocking that out. So you figure there's six of those on a building. And so all of a sudden now we're making really good money. We were making such good money that by the time 2 weeks was out, we'd finished everything they had. We were out having to look for something else. Do you think I could do that in 1 week by myself? By the time I put up all the scaffold, by the time I'd have to go load it up there, then run upstairs and get it all off and drag it off, sit on sawhorses, cut it all up, go inside, come outside, back in, back out. Do you think you could do it by yourself? Is there a better return for two than one? Absolutely. Two people can work better than one person can work. And what's the benefit with two instead of one? What's another benefit? You take some young person along, take some guy that's a novice that doesn't have any skills, and what are you doing? You're teaching him how to work, and you're teaching him a skill, and he is able then to learn and to make a living and to provide for himself. And so when you look at it, you know, there's a reason for it. It's not just for the profitability. It's not just for the money. It's the fact that if you're working with at least two, if there's more than one, you're mentoring somebody else. You're showing them how to do the skills that you have so that you're passing on a trade so somebody else can do this. And if we only live for ourselves, then what have we got? we're back to the first paragraph, aren't we? To the guy that strives and labors and works and is never satisfied with these riches. But the fact that two of you can sit down when the job's over and enjoy a soda pop together and look at what you've done and go, gosh, that was great. And now we got 2 days off because we've done it all in four. We got 2 days off that we can go and load up the next one, or we can go down and go fishing or go swimming down to the beach because we're staying ahead. We're able to get our work done. We're able to enjoy the things that we're doing. Now, I think there's a profitability that goes beyond the finances. I think there's a profitability that goes because, one, you're building a relationship with somebody else, and also you're providing for two people instead of just one. And that's one thing about anyone that has run a business, that they're never working for themselves. Every time you have to get a, you've got to get jobs. You can't, no business just runs because, well, you open the door and I'm making widgets. There's got to be somebody that's going to buy widgets, or else you're going to overstock with widgets and there's just going to be shelves and shelves and shelves and warehouses full of widgets. There's got to be somebody that needs them, isn't there? So there's got to be a productivity that says that I'm doing something that someone needs, and we're teaching somebody how to do this so that they too can work. And so you've got to go out and sell so that somebody else, so that you're providing for other families beyond your own. And so it begins to extend itself. The second thing is that there's help in time of need. How many of us ever fall down? And I'm not talking about physically. How many of us ever have something that happens in our life that we've hit the ground and we need somebody to help us get up? Come on, yeah. Most of us at some point or another. So we fall down and there's nobody there to help. You know, we break down and there's nobody to call. When we do everything by ourselves, there's no one to depend upon. Have you ever broke down on the side of the road? It helps if you're in Texas. In Texas, if you break down, there's always a cowboy or redneck that's going to pull over and give you a hand, isn't he? They're just going to do it. There's other states you break down, and you can just count on it. They're not going to do anything. I remember we were coming back from Indiana one time, and we crossed over the Mississippi coming into Missouri. And there was a car that was sitting on the side of the road, and the thing was smoking under the hood. And I told Francis, I said, that car's on fire. Now, one flame's coming out, but I said, that car's on fire. And everybody driving down the highway, it's an interstate, and nobody stops. So we pull in, and I got both girls and Frances. And anyhow, we pull up, and it's a high school girl. She's on her way. She lives in southern Illinois and going to work in Sykeston, Missouri at McDonald's. And so here she is, and all of her stuff's in the car, and now flames are coming out. So I help her get everything out of her car. We call 911. We get in the van. We're sitting back at a safe distance, and nobody's stopping. Nobody. So you've got to have people. You've got to be concerned for folks. You've got to be willing to stop and to help, because people do fall down. They do need help, don't they? Going to Madisonville back last year, they were doing some work in some kind of a median up there north of Huntsville, and a young lady was coming from Houston going to Dallas to see her brother, a young Vietnamese girl, and she had a blowout. One of these small cars, and gosh, she had a donut that was, I don't think you'd get full if you ate it. It was so small. I mean, that little thing, it was pitiful looking. And she broke down, and she's halfway between Huntsville and Madisonville. And cars are just, you know, it looks like Houston when you're going between Dallas and Houston on a weekend. It's horrible. And we pulled over and, you know, get you out, and she has no clue how to change it. So we change her tire and get a chance to visit with her, and she's sitting with Francis in the truck. And get her tire fixed, and we follow her to Madisonville and tell her, you know, call your brother. We tried to get her to stop so we could get a tire for her, but she goes, no, I'm going to go on. So told her, call your brother and stay in contact with him, because this donut may not make it to Dallas. But nobody was stopping. Nobody was stopping. When we fall down, we need someone that's going to be there to help us get up, don't we? We need someone to stop and say, I'll help you. I'll render aid. I'll come to your rescue. And he tells us that if one is overpowered, if there's two, you can take a stand. You can face up against it. You know, if you're by yourself, and I understand this because of being up here. Friday, I was up here, and two guys come pulling around the building in a GMC jacked up four-wheel drive for no good. And I come out of the garage because I'm working on the tractor. You know, what do? One person, it's hard. How does one person face off two guys? If they decide to get out of the truck, how's one person face, you know, stand them off? But I'm just crazy enough that I get out or come out of the garage, and I got, you know, this thing on the side of my pants that looks like a holster, but it's got pliers in it. And I put my hand right here, and the guys kind of look, and they look at me, they look, and they back up, they take off. But it happens often, back there especially. If there's two people, they're not going to stay. They're going to hit the corner, and they're going to turn around, and they're just going to go. But there's one, they'll show up, won't they, Mike? They'll be back there, and then you've got a situation. You've got to deal with something. So two people is better than one. Even in defense, it's better than one. And if you've got a string, and again, it's just a cord, a string. If you've got a string, how hard is it to pull the string apart? But if you take and weave it together so that there's three, then how hard is it to break one that's wrapped in three? If you take a rope, it's hard to break. But if you take a string, how easy is it to break? And so having more is better. Well, why three? Well, you take a spouse and her husband, and you take the Lord, it's hard to break that, isn't it? When God's in the family, it's hard to break. If you have three that are working together, it's hard to break. And so there is a benefit to multiplicity. But one is quickly broken. These are not broken, not quickly. So there's the protection. There's comfort, there's help, there's profitability. All of these things that come because he says better is two than one. And then he tells us that wisdom is better than wealth and power, especially if the one that has wealth and power is foolish. So it is better for a child who is poor but wise than a king who is a rich fool, rich and foolish. You know, my grandmother, the great-grandmother, was born in 1864. She lived 5 miles from us, and so we saw her all the time. And she'd sit down and she'd tell me, I was the oldest of the boys, and she'd tell me, she'd go, now, Bill, you need to get all the education you can get, because that's one thing that can't be stolen from you. And so maybe that was my push or something that drive that kept me going to school, because Dad began to ask someplace around 14 years, going, now, Phil, is there a retirement? Do they have benefits of going to college? Because it seemed like I was never going to get out. And it took longer than that. I guess I was probably in college, graduate school, at least 18 years. That's a long time, isn't it? That's a real long time. Gosh, I don't know why I was so slow. But, you know, it takes time. But those things, wisdom, how do you steal that? You can be poor and wise, can't you? And you can be the king and as rich as all get out, but if you're a fool and can't receive admonition, can't be admonished, no one can instruct you, no one can say, you know, I don't think that's a good idea. I remember WL and Doyle Barkley, they worked out here at the plant on locomotives. And there was a guy at the locomotive that had a steam valve on one of the locomotives. And when the steam released, this valve would close. And so the guy was in there working around, and he stuck his finger in a hole where that steam valve was. And when the pressure went off, guess what happened to his finger? It was gone. So the safety manager comes down, and he wants to know what happened. And he goes, well, I stuck my finger right in here, and the steam valve released, and now he's walking around. He doesn't have an index finger on either hand. And they fired him because they thought he was a safety hazard. You know, gosh, if you can't receive an admonition, you know, I think that how many times would I have to do that? How many times would you have to stick your finger in there? One time. Missing my first finger, because if you're right-handed, you're going to stick your right-hand finger in there, right? So now I don't have this finger. Do you think I'm going to stick this finger back in there and show him? I might stick a pencil, but my finger's not going in there. What was it the Gomer Pyle said? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And so we ought to learn admonition. But some people, you can't give them instruction at all because they will not listen. We all need admonishment at some point, don't we? And so he says, because they don't know how to receive that. And then he gives us the illustration of both Joseph and David in verse 14. Joseph had been bound in a prison of chains. But when he came out, he had become as king, hadn't he? He was second only to Pharaoh. Whatever he said in all of Egypt was done. And if he said that this is what you're going to do, that's what they did. And if he said this is what the tax is going to be, that's what they brought. And they brought all their grain, and they stored it in storehouses. And when it came time to sell, he told them this is what the cost is. And when they finally lost everything, then he began to portion out, and they became indentured servants or farmers, and he began to portion out amounts of grain, and then they had to pay a fifth of it back in tax, which is 20%. And so he became king. He was as king to all of them. And there was another one who was born in poverty, and yet he had entered into his kingdom, and that was David. He was the least of all of his brothers. You know, if the firstborn gets the birthright and he gets the blessing, and David had seven brothers and he was the youngest child, what was it that he was going to ever have to look forward to from his father's house? What was he going to get from his dad? Maybe a sheep or two? But everything was going to go to his brothers because he's the last, you know, he's the last on the line, wasn't he? And so here he is, a boy, a child born in poverty, and he winds up with a kingdom, doesn't he? And so you look at the old fool, the king that can't receive admonishment, and yet you find a young man that is in chains that comes out to be as king, and another one that's born in poverty that comes out to have a kingdom. So wisdom's better than wealth and power if you're wise. But it does no good. Wealth and power does no good to the fool. And lastly, in the succession of kings, kings come and kings go. And the new king is no more significant than the old one because both pass and we don't remember them. Now, I was watching a video. A friend of mine, a girl that I graduated from high school, lives in Florida. And she passed on a little video from a news source from her area. And they're interviewing people down on the beach. And so they go up to the guy and they said, you know, what do you think about today? And the guy goes, what happened today? He goes, well, JFK died today. He goes, he did? Who's JFK? I mean, asking these, John Kennedy was assassinated today. What do you think about that? You know, was he sick? You know, what happened? You know, where was he? And they're asking the question. And they asked the question. They said, so what do you think about Joe Biden? And one guy, he's sitting there, he goes, is he a baseball player? You would not believe the responses they were getting. No one had, you know, JFK died last week. Gosh, I didn't know. You know, was there, you know, where was it? You know, who is he? And Joe Biden, you know, Joe Biden's maybe sings or something. Was he in the Oscars? You know, it was hilarious listening to him. So who's going to be remembered? Who's going to be remembered? What was the name of the U.S. The Supreme Court justice that died that's getting ready to be replaced? Well, see, there's some that know, but I bet that if we hadn't have said it out loud and I passed out around pieces of paper, that it wouldn't be all of us that would remember it, would it? And if we were to say who are the last two that got put onto the Supreme Court, might get one of them, but to get both of them, gosh, I don't know. And who were the last three secretaries of state? Who was the last one? Yeah, gosh, all of a sudden we're in, you know, who really is remembered? Who gets remembered? And that's what he said. He said the succession of kings, the new one's no more significant than the one that's passed. He said, I turned and I saw the living and those who are walking, the living, not the dead, and those who are walking about. And the second one, the second child, he stands up after him, and his end is that of all the people, and all of them are just like those who came before them, and those that come after them, there is no rejoicing in them. Nobody remembers them. They forget them. Now, some of us who are older, we may have the nostalgia of being able to go back and talk about our old favorite baseball players or football players or basketball players or whatever. But you bring it up to the kids, to younger people, and they're going to go, who? Who is that? And they have no clue, do they? And when we're gone, they're not going to remember us either. That's comforting, isn't it? So if we're searching for significance in what we're leaving behind, you better find another thing to seek significance in. Because the significance isn't in us. It's really in the fact that two are better than one. That we take somebody else along, that we're not living for ourselves, that we're not accumulating all in life just to spend it on me. Now look around and say, who am I leaving this to? What's the legacy? Who's the heritage? How am I benefiting someone else? You know, what are my children, my kids and my grandkids? Because that is really the honor that you not only leave for your children, but you live for your grandchildren as well. And the greatest thing that you can leave is a heritage of Christian faith, isn't it? That's the most important thing, that you take them along and you lead them in such a way that your children follow you as well, that they don't leave it behind and it's something that dad did, it's something that grandma did, you know, it's not really for me. And I think about my mom. You know, Danny, you lost yours last year. It's been a year because it was, what, in January? February. And Joe lost his. And last year, there's a bunch of us that lost family last year. And I think about my mom. And if it had not been for my mom, and I didn't know this until we were talking about that before the funeral. If it hadn't been for my mom, I don't know that any of my family on the Sigmund side would have ever been in church. Because Dad and Mom's first date, when he asked her, they double dated on a Saturday night and went to one of those figure eight race car things. And she wasn't Dad's date. She was sitting with another guy, but they sat beside each other and they talked all night. And he asked her if she would like to go out on a date. She goes, well, I'm going to church tomorrow if you'd like to go. And so Dad went to church the next morning. That was her first date. They went to church. And because Mom took Dad to church, Dad came to faith in Christ, and Dad became a member of the church. Then my grandma and grandpa started going to church because Mom and Dad were going to church. And then my great-grandmother started going to church because, well, grandma and grandpa went to church, and she lived with them. And then Dad's youngest brother and his wife started going to church, and all their kids are serving the Lord. And Dad's oldest brother just died that was 91 and a half. He and his family started going to church, and they're all serving the Lord. And where did it all start? My mom. That on a date, she said, I'm going to church. And Dad was smitten, and so he decided, guess what? I'm going to church too. If she's going to church, I'm going to church. And all of a sudden, there is a legacy that goes beyond me and my family, that goes all through our whole family, because one said, I'm going to do something that's right. So is it that important? Is it that important? I met my wife at church, and all my kids are Christians. My grandkids are Christians, and love and serve the Lord. And they got their start where? Because you live for more than just yourself. You live beyond yourself. Would it be easy? Josh was saying this morning, and I close with this. Josh was saying this morning, he said, I get up, and I at 6:15, I come to Port Arthur to get Wesley. I have the special needs class upstairs, and to get Wesley, and then we go eat breakfast. And he says, you would not believe all the boats that were heading out at 6:15 to go down to Sabine Lake to go fishing. And he said, that is such a shame, such a shame. Now, Josh is 37 years old, and he's saying, that's such a shame. But where did Josh come to faith in Christ? Here. And why? Because his grandma came to church, Opal Philman. She came to church here, and she had his mom come to church here. Can we leave something more than money? You leave them money, how long does it last? Not long. If you leave them the Christian faith, if you leave them something of great importance, you give them something, a heritage, how long does it last? From one generation to the next generation to the next generation to the next. So spend your life on the most important things. Don't spend it on lesser things. Give your life to that which is most important. Leave a heritage. Don't just leave your stuff wondering, well, who's going to get it? Father God, we thank you. We thank you that you have called us to live for more, to live our lives for Jesus Christ, and that the greatest heritage will be left behind us is not our name, but your fame, that people will honor and glorify you, and they will live their lives to glorify you, and one day we will rejoice with them in heaven because they have followed you. But God, that we have left your glory and not our